You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is part 7, the last part. I'm going to read this last section and the epilogue in this same section 7 of the book Mystics After Modernism, Discovering the Seeds of a New Science in the Renaissance. This part 7 is entitled Giordano Bruno and Angelus Silesius, and it will also include the epilogue. At Castle Heilsberg in Prussia, during the first decade of the 16th century, the scientific genius Nicholas Copernicus erected a framework of ideas that compelled those of following eras to gaze at the starry heavens in a way unlike that of our predecessors of antiquity or the Middle Ages. To the people of medieval times, the earth was a dwelling at rest in the center of the universe. The stars, on the other hand, were perfect entities that moved in circles, the circle being the image of perfection. Human beings saw in the sensory manifestations of the stars something belonging directly to the soul or the spirit. The objects and events of the earth spoke one language to humankind, while another language was spoken by the shining stars, which in the pure ether beyond the moon seemed to be spiritual beings filling all of space. Nicholas of Cusa had formed different ideas. Through the explanations of Copernicus, the earth became for humankind a fellow creation among heavenly bodies, a star that moved like any other. If anything on earth appeared somewhat different, it could be attributed only to the fact that we live here. People were forced to stop viewing earthly phenomena any differently than they did phenomena in the rest of the universe. The sensory world had expanded into the most distant space. They had to accept that everything that reaches the eye from the ether is a part of the sensory realm, no different than the things of earth. With the senses, they could no longer look for spirit in the ether. After that, all who worked for higher knowledge had to come to terms with this expanded sensory world. In earlier centuries, the meditating human spirit had faced a different world. Now it was given a new task. It was no longer only the things of the earth that could express their nature from the inner human being. This interior had to embrace the spirit of a sensory world, one that fills the spatial universe everywhere in the same way. This was the kind of task that confronted Giordano Bruno, the thinker from Nola, footnote, Filippo Bruno, 1548-1600, was born in Nola, near Naples, the son of Giovanni Bruno, a soldier, and Fraulissa Sabolino. He took the name Giordano upon entering the Dominican order. In the monastery in Naples where Thomas Aquinas had taught, Bruno studied Aristotelian philosophy. His exceptional abilities took him to Rome and to the Pope. During this period, he may also have come under the influence of Giovanni Battista della Porta, a Neapolitan polymath, who published an important book on natural magic. Bruno was attracted to new streams of thought, among which were the works of Plato and Hermes Trismegistus, both resurrected in Florence by Marsilio Ficino in the late 15th century. Because of his heterodox tendencies, Bruno drew the attention of the Inquisition. For the next 7 years he lived in France, lecturing on various subjects, and published Cena della Ceneri, the Ash Wednesday Supper, and De l'Infinito Universo e Mondi, on the infinite universe and worlds, both in 1584. In Cena della Ceneri, Bruno defended the heliocentric theory of Copernicus. In Venice, he was arrested by the Inquisition and tried. After he had recanted, Bruno was sent to Rome in 1592 for another trial. For 8 years he was kept imprisoned and interrogated. In the end, he refused to recant, was declared a heretic, and burned at the stake. End of footnote. The senses had conquered the spatial universe for themselves. Spirit could no longer be found in space. Consequently, human beings were prompted externally to look for spirit, on the basis of deep inner experiences, only where it had been sought by the brilliant thinkers I have discussed in the preceding chapters. These thinkers drew out of themselves a worldview that a more advanced natural science would later force on humankind. The sun of ideas that later illuminated a new understanding of nature was still beyond the horizon for those thinkers, but even then its light appeared as a dawn when human thinking about nature was still enclosed within the darkness of night. For the purposes of science, the 16th century gave the heavens to the world of the senses, to which they rightfully belong. Until the end of the 19th century, science had progressed to the degree that it could attribute to the sensory world what rightfully belonged to it among the phenomena of plant, animal, and human life. Science henceforth could look only for factual sensory processes, whether in the ether or in the development of living organisms. The 16th century thinker was compelled to say that the earth is a star among stars, subject to the same laws as other stars. And the 19th century thinker had to say, quote, whatever their origin and future may be, in the context of anthropology, human beings are only mammals. Specifically, they are mammals whose organization, needs, and diseases are the most complicated, and whose brain, with its wonderful capacity, has reached the highest degree of development. Close quote, footnote Paul Topinard, Anthropologie, Anthropologie Leipzig, 1888, page 528, end of footnote. Based on this view attained by science, the confusion about spirit and the sensory world became impossible if people understood themselves correctly. Advanced science makes it impossible to look in nature for a spirit conceived in a materialistic way. Just as sound thinking compels us to look at the laws of mechanics to find out why the hands of a clock advance, quote, the spirit of inorganic nature, close quote, rather than looking for a particular demon who causes the hands to move. As a scientist, Ernst Haeckel justifiably rejected the clumsy view of a material god. Quote, in the higher, more abstract forms of religion, this corporeal manifestation is abandoned, and God is worshipped only as pure spirit, without body. Quote, God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth, close quote, John 4:24. Nevertheless, the spiritual activity of this pure spirit is exactly the same as that of the anthropomorphous divine personality. In reality, this immaterial spirit, too, is not thought of as incorporeal, but as invisible, gaseous. We thus come to the paradoxical view of God as an ethereal vertebrate, close quote, footnote, from Ernst Haeckel, titled The Riddle of the Universe, Berlin, 1899, page 333, end of footnote. In fact, the real sensory existence of a spiritual reality can be assumed only where an immediate sensory experience reveals the spirit, and spirit can be assumed only to the degree that it is perceived in this way. The great thinker Bartholomaeus von Carneri, 1821 to 1909, said, quote, the words, no spirit without matter, but also no matter without spirit, would justify extending the problem to plants or even to the first rock we encounter, in which hardly anything could be said in favor of this correlation. Close quote. Bartholomaeus von Carneri, title Empfindung und Bewusstsein, Sensation and Consciousness, Bonn, 1893, page 15, end of footnote. Spiritual processes as facts are the results of various functions of an organism. The spirit of the world does not exist in the world in a material way, but in a spiritual way only. The human soul is the sum of the processes in which spirit appears most directly as a fact. But it is only in the human being that spirit exists as such a soul. To look for spirit as a soul anywhere but in a human being, to view other beings as endowed with a soul like that of a human being, is to misunderstand spirit. It is to commit the most grievous sin against the spirit. Those who make this mistake reveal that they have not experienced Spirit itself, but only an external manifestation of Spirit that rules in them, that is, the soul. It is as if somebody were to mistake a circle drawn in pencil for the true mathematical ideal circle. Those who experience within themselves only a soul form of Spirit feel the need to assume such a soul form in non-human things, so that they do not have to stop at gross sensory materiality. Instead of conceiving of the primordial foundation of the world as Spirit, they think of it as a world soul and assume a general animation of nature. Under the impact of the new Copernican view of nature, Giordano Bruno could grasp the Spirit in the world, from which it had been driven in its old form, only as a world soul. Those who immerse themselves in Bruno's writings, especially in his profound book titled Cause, Principle, and Unity, have the impression that he conceived of things as animated, though to various degrees. He had not really experienced Spirit within himself, and thus imagined it in terms of the human soul, the only form in which it confronted him. When he speaks of the Spirit, he understands it in this way, quote, "Universal reason is the most inward and real and characteristic faculty, and it is a potential part of the world soul. It is the same everywhere, and fills the all in all. It illuminates the universe and instructs nature in producing its species as they should be." Close quote. It is true that in these sentences the Spirit is not described as an, quote, "ethereal vertebrate," close quote, but as a being like the human soul. Quote, "A thing, however minute, has within itself a portion of spiritual substance, that, if it finds the substratum to be suitable, strives to become a plant or an animal, and organizes itself into some kind of body, which is generally considered animated. Spirit may be found in all things, and there is not the most minute body that does not contain such a portion of it that it animates itself." Close quote. Because Giordano Bruno had not really experienced Spirit as such within himself, he could confuse the life of Spirit with those outer mechanical functions by means of which Raymond Lull, 1235 to 1315, in his so-called Great Art, had attempted to unveil the mysteries of the Spirit. Footnote, Raymond Lull, or Raymond Lully, 1235 to 1316, Catalan mystic, philosopher, poet, and missionary. After an early life at the court of Majorca as a lyrical troubadour, he experienced mystical visions and left court to devote himself to philosophy and missionary work. He traveled in Asia Minor and North Africa in attempts to convert Muslims. According to legend, he was stoned to death. As a philosopher, he was primarily a Neoplatonic Aristotelian. His main work was Ars Magna. End of footnote. The modern philosopher Franz Brentano described great art, in quotes. Various concepts were inscribed on concentric circular disks that can be turned individually, and in this way diverse combinations were produced. Footnote, Franz Brentano, titled Die vier Phasen der Philosophie und ihr augenblicklicher Stand, Stuttgart 1895, page 20. Brentano, 1838 to 1917, was a German philosopher and professor in Würzburg and Vienna. He presented his ideas on act psychology or intentionalism, Aristotle, logic, and ethics in books such as titled Psychologie von empirischen Standpunkten, 1874, and titled Von der Klassifikation der psychischen Phänomene, 1911, C. Steiner's titled Riddles of the Soul, Chapter 3, Franz Brentano in Memoriam. End of footnote. Sorry for my German there. A coincidence superimposed on a particular turn was formed into a judgment concerning the highest truths. In his extensive wanderings throughout Europe, Giordano Bruno appeared at various universities as a teacher of the, in quotes, great art. He was bold enough to conceive of the stars as worlds completely analogous to our Earth. He enlarged the vision of scientific thinking beyond the Earth. He no longer thought of the heavenly bodies as corporeal spirits, but thought of them as spirits of the soul. One must not do an injustice to this man, whom the Catholic Church put to death for his advanced ideas. It was an enormous achievement to enfold the whole heavens within the same concept of the world that until then had been applied only to the earthly things. Though Bruno still conceived of the sensory realm as belonging to the soul. In the 17th century, the thinker Johannes Scheffler, called Angelus Silesius, made the visions of Tauler, Weigel, Jakob Boehme, and others shine once more in a great spiritual harmony. Footnote: Johannes Scheffler or Angelus Silesius, 1624 to 1677, Polish mystic, polemicist, and poet, was trained as a physician and ordained a Catholic priest. He spoke vigorously for the Counter-Reformation. The title Cherubinic Wanderer, 6 volumes, is his important written work. End of footnote. The ideas of the older thinkers appear in his book Cherubinic Wanderer, as though gathered in a spiritual focus and shining with a heightened luminosity. Everything Silesius said appears as a direct and spontaneous revelation of his personality, making it seem as though he was destined by Providence to embody wisdom in a personal form. The spontaneous way his life expressed that wisdom is shown in his sayings, which may be admired as well for their artistic quality. He hovered above earthly existence like a spiritual being, and what he said is like a breath from another world. Cleansed entirely of all those coarse and impure elements that human wisdom must struggle to leave behind. In the philosophy of Angelus Silesius, only those who cause the I-E-Y-E of the all in all to see within them may partake of true cognition, and only those who feel that their acts are performed by the hand of the all in all may see them in their true light. Quote, God is the fire within me, and I am the light in him. Do we not belong to each other intimately? I am as rich as God. There is no grain of dust that I do not have in common with him. Dear people, believe me, God loves me above himself. If I love him above myself, I give him as much as he gives me. The bird is in the air. The stone lies on the land, the fish lives in the water, and my spirit is in God's hands. If you are born of God, then God flowers in you, and his divinity is your sap and adornment. Stop! What are you chasing after? Heaven is within you. If you are looking for God anywhere else, you will always miss him. Close quote. For those who feel that they exist in the all-in-all in this way, all separation between themselves and other beings cease. Such people no longer view themselves as separate individuals. On the contrary, they feel everything about themselves is a part of the world, and that their true essence is identical with the universe itself. Quote, the world does not hold you. Rather, you are the world that within you and with you keeps you so powerfully imprisoned. You will not have perfect bliss until oneness has swallowed the otherness. You are all things. If you lack one thing, you do not know your true wealth. Close quote. As sensory beings, we are, in quotes, things, among other things. And our sensory organs give us, as sensing individualities, information about the objects outside us in space and time. When spirit speaks in us, however, outside and inside cease to exist. Nothing spiritual is here or there, earlier or later. Space and time disappear in contemplating universal spirit. Only when we see as individuals are we here and the thing there. Only when we see as individuals is one thing earlier and another later. Quote, friends, when you let your spirit rise above place and time, you can be in eternity every moment. I myself am eternity when I leave time and collect myself in God and God in myself. The rose that your outer eye sees here has flowered like this in God through eternity. Sit in the center and you will see everything at once, what happens both now and then, both here and in heaven. My friend, as long as place and time is in your mind, you will never comprehend the nature of God in eternity. When we withdraw from multiplicity and commune with God, we attain oneness. Close quote. Here we climb to the heights that go beyond individual self and abolish every distinction between world and self. A higher life begins. The inner experience that arises appears as the death of our old life and as resurrection in the new. Quote, when you rise above yourself and let God act, then the ascension will take place in your spirit. The body must elevate itself in the spirit, the spirit in God, if you, dear friend, wish to live in Him forever in bliss. To the degree that my eye pines away and diminishes in me, the eye of the Lord is strengthened. Close quote. It is from this point of view that people can understand their significance and that of everything in the realm of eternal necessity. The natural universe appears to them directly as divine spirit. The thought of a divine universal spirit that could have its being and continuity above and alongside the things of the world disappears as a conquered concept. This universal spirit seems to permeate things so completely and has become so entirely one with their nature that it is no longer possible to imagine even a single aspect of its being as absent. Quote, there is nothing but I and you. If we too do not exist, then God is God no more, and the heavens shall fall. Close quote. Human beings feel themselves to be a necessary link in the chain of the world. Their acts no longer have any element of arbitrariness or individuality. What they do is necessary to the whole, to the chain of the world, which would fall apart if what they do were taken out of it. Quote, without me, God cannot make a single worm. If I do not preserve it with Him, it must straightway fall to pieces. I know that without me, God cannot live for an instant. If I come to nothing, He must give up the ghost. Close quote. It is only on this height that people see things in their true nature. They no longer need to attribute a spiritual essence externally to the smallest, coarsest phenomena. It is, in all its smallness and its gross sensory nature, it is a part of the all in all. Quote, no dust mote is so poor, no dot is so small, but the wise person sees God in it in His glory. In a mustard seed, if you can understand it, is the image of all higher and lower things. Close quote. At this level of understanding, a person feels free, because coercion exists only where one can still be compelled externally. When everything outside has flowed into the interior, when the contrast between I and world, outside and inside, nature and spirit, has disappeared, then only their own impulses are experienced as compelling. Quote, bind me as tight as you like, in 1,000 irons. I will nevertheless be completely free and unfettered. When my will is dead, then God must do my will. I myself prescribe for Him the pattern and the goal. Close quote. All externally imposed moral norms cease to exist. Human beings become their own measure and goal. They are not subject to any law, because the law too has become their own nature. Quote, the law is for the wicked. If no commandment were written, the godly would nevertheless love God and their neighbors. Close quote. On the higher level of cognition, the innocence of nature is returned to the human being. People accomplish the tasks assigned to them with the awareness of an eternal necessity. They say to themselves that through this iron necessity it is given into their hands to withdraw the part that is assigned to them from the same eternal necessity. Quote, "Dear people, let the flower in the meadow show you how to please God and be beautiful at the same time. The rose does not ask why. It blooms because it blooms. It pays no attention to itself, nor does it wonder if anyone sees it." Close quote. When we rise to a higher level of understanding, we feel within ourselves the eternal and necessary impulse of the universe. Just like the flower of the field, we act just as the flower does in blooming. In all our actions, the awareness of our moral responsibility grows into the infinite. What we fail to do is withdrawn from the all in all. It kills this all in all, insofar as it is possible to kill the all in all. Quote, "What does it mean not to sin? Do not ask much. Go. The silent flowers will tell you. Everything must be slain. If you do not slay yourself for God, eternal death will eventually slay you for the enemy." Close quote. And that's the end of the section on Giordano Bruno and Angelus Silesius. I am now reading the epilogue, which will finish this book. There is a rather large afterword by another person. I'm not including that since it's not by Rudolf Steiner himself. Again, epilogue. Almost 2.5 centuries have passed since Angelus Silesius gathered in title Cherubinic Wanderer the profound wisdom of his precursors. Those centuries have brought rich insights into nature. Goethe opened a vast perspective into natural science. He pursued the eternally fixed laws of nature's work up to the peak where they produced humankind just as inevitably as on a lower level they produce stones. Lamarck, Darwin, Haeckel, and others continued to work in the spirit of that thinking. And the, quote, "question of questions," quote, close quote, was answered in the 19th century. That is, what is the origin of humankind? Other questions in the realm of natural processes have also been solved. Today we know that it is unnecessary to go beyond the realm of facts and the senses to understand in a purely natural way the sequence of beings in human evolution. The nature of the human eye, too, has been illuminated by the discernment of Johann Fichte, who showed the people where to look for the soul and described its nature. Hegel extended the domain of thought to cover all fields of being and endeavored to comprehend in thought the outer sensory existence of nature, as well as the highest creations of the human spirit and the laws that govern them. How do those men, whose thinking this work outlines, appear in light of a worldview that includes the scientific advancements of periods since theirs? They still believed in a, quote, supernatural, close quote, history of creation. How do their thoughts appear in the face of natural views developed by 19th century science? Science has not attributed anything to nature that does not belong there. It has removed from nature only what does not belong to it. Science ridded nature of everything that cannot be found there, but only within the human being. Science no longer sees a force in nature that resembles the human soul and acts like a human being. It no longer proclaims an anthropomorphized God that creates organic forms, but describes their development in the sensory world strictly according to natural laws. Meister Eckhart, as well as Johannes Tauler, Jakob Boehme, and Angelus Silesius, would feel profoundly at home contemplating natural science. When understood properly, one sees that the spirit of their worldview had developed fully into this view of nature. They could not illuminate the reality of nature through the light that arose within them. But this would have, no doubt, become their desire had natural science been available to them. They were unable to see nature in this light because no geology and no natural history of creation informed them of those natural processes. Only the Bible spoke in its own way of such processes. Thus, to the best of their ability, they looked for spirit in the only place it may be found, in the human being. Today they would use very different resources, by means accessible to the senses, to show that spirit may be found only in the human being. They would agree entirely with those who look for the reality of spirit not at the root of nature, but in its fruit. They would admit that the spirit in the sensory body is the result of development and cannot be found at lower levels of development. They would understand that no creative thought is active in the forming spirit in an organism any more than creative thought caused apes to develop from marsupials. In our own time, people cannot speak of natural facts, as did Jacob Boehme. But today there is also a viewpoint that brings Boehme's thinking closer to a worldview that includes modern science. It is not necessary to lose the spirit when one finds only what is natural in nature. Of course, today there are many who think that one must slip into a shallow, dry materialism by accepting the discoveries of natural science at face value. I myself stand completely upon the ground of this natural science. I am convinced that a view of nature like that of Ernst Haeckel becomes shallow only when people approach it with a world of ideas that is already shallow. When I let the revelations of a natural history of creation affect me, I feel something higher and more glorious than when I confront the stories of supernatural miracles of the creed. I know of nothing in holy books that reveals anything as sublime as the so-called dry fact that every human fetus rapidly progresses through a succession of all the forms through which its animal ancestors evolved. Let us fill our minds with the magnificent facts that our senses perceive, and we will have little care for supernatural miracles. If we experience spirit within ourselves, we do not need spirit in external nature. In my title, Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, a Philosophy of Freedom, I describe my worldview, which does not eliminate spirit, because it views nature just as Darwin and Haeckel viewed it. A plant or an animal does not gain anything if I attribute to it a soul not perceived by my senses. I do not look for a deeper spiritual nature of things in the external world. I do not even assume it, because I believe that the knowledge illuminating my inner self prevents me from doing so. I believe that things of the sensory world are as they appear to be, because I see that true self-knowledge leads us to look only for natural processes in nature. I do not look for divine spirit in nature, because I believe I perceive the essence of human spirit in myself. I calmly acknowledge my animal ancestors, because I realize that no soul-like spirit can be active in the origins of these animal ancestors. I agree with Ernst Haeckel only in his preference for the, quote, eternal stillness of the grave, close quote, to the immortality of many religious doctrines. I consider it to be a degradation and an abhorrent sin against spirit to conceive of a soul that continues to exist like a sensory being. I hear a shrill dissonance when the facts of natural science, according to Haeckel, encounter the pious creeds of many contemporaries. In creeds that harmonize poorly with natural facts, I do not hear any of the spirit of the higher piety of Jacob Boehme and Angelus Silesius. That piety harmonizes fully with the activity of the natural world. There is no contradiction in being permeated with the insights of modern science and at the same time embarking upon the road that Boehme and Silesius pursued in their search for the spiritual. Those who take this road in the mode of those thinkers do not have to worry about slipping into shallow materialism, as long as they allow the secrets of nature to be told by a natural history of creation. Those who interpret my ideas in this sense will understand, as I do, the last saying of the title Cherubinic Wanderer, which will also sound the last note of this book. Quote, "Dear friend, this is enough for now. If you wish to read more, go and become the writing and the essence yourself." Close quote. Footnote, page 5, this footnote was added in the 1923 edition. The final sentences should not be misinterpreted as expressing an unspiritual view of nature. I wanted only to strongly emphasize that the spirit at the root of nature must be found within it and not to be brought to it externally. The rejection of, quote, creative thoughts, close quote, refers to an activity like human activity, which acts according to ideas of utility. What is to be said about evolutionary history may be found in my preface to the new edition of titled The Theory of Knowledge and Goethe's Conception of the World, Rudolf Steiner, 1923. And the last thing he, end of footnote there, and again when he said, quote, "Dear friend, this is enough for now. If you wish to read more, go and become the writing and the essence yourself," close quote, is from The Cherubinic Wanderer. And that is the end of the epilogue and the end of this last section and the end of this book, Mystics After Modernism.